He groped for the stein, raised it, and drank a third of it. Frozen, Ricky Lee watched his Adam's apple go up and down. Hanscom set the stein aside, shuddered twice, then nodded. He looked at Ricky Lee and smiled a little. His eyes were no longer red. Works about like they said it did. You are so fucking concerned about your nose that you never feel what's going down your throat at all. You're crazy, Mr. Hanscom, Ricky Lee said. You bet your fur, Mr. Hanscom said. You remember that one, Ricky Lee? We used to say that when we were kids. You bet your fur. Did I ever tell you I used to be fat? No, sir, you never did, Ricky Lee whispered. He was now convinced that Mr. Hanscom had received some intelligence so dreadful that the man really had gone crazy, or at least taken temporary leave of his senses. I was a regular butterball. Never played baseball or basketball. Always got caught first when we played tag. Couldn't keep out of my own way. I was fat, all right. And there were these fellows in my hometown who used to take after me pretty regularly. There was a fellow named Reginald Huggins, only everyone called him Belch. A kid named Victor Chris, a few other guys. But the real brains of the combination was a fellow named Henry Bowers. If there has ever been a genuinely evil kid strutting across the skin of the world, Ricky Lee, Henry Bowers was that kid. I wasn't the only kid he used to take after. My problem was, I couldn't run as fast as some of the others. Hanscom unbuttoned his shirt and opened it. Leaning forward, Ricky Lee saw a funny twisted scar on Mr. Hanscom's stomach, just above his navel, puckered, white, and old. It was a letter, he saw. Someone had carved the letter H into the man's stomach, probably long before Mr. Hanscom had been a man. Henry Bowers did that to me about 1,000 years ago. I'm lucky I'm not wearing his whole damn name down there. Mr. Hanscom. Hanscom took the other two lemon slices, one in each hand, tilted his head back, and took them like nose drops. He shuddered rackingly, put them aside, and took two big swallows from the stein. He shuddered again, took another gulp, and then groped for the padded edge of the bar with his eyes closed. For a moment, he held on like a man on a sailboat clinging to the rail for support in a heavy sea. Then he opened his eyes again and smiled at Ricky Lee. I could ride this bull all night, he said. Mr. Hanscom, I wish you wouldn't do that anymore, Ricky Lee said nervously. Annie came over to the waitress's stand with her tray and called for a couple of millers. Ricky Lee drew them and took them down to her. His legs felt rubbery. Is Mr. Hanscom all right, Ricky Lee? Annie asked. She was looking past Ricky Lee, and he turned to follow her gaze. Mr. Hanscom was leaning over the bar, carefully picking lemon slices out of the caddy where Ricky Lee kept the drink garnishes. I don't know, he said. I don't think so. Well, get your thumb out of your ass and do something about it. Annie was, like most other women, partial to Ben Hanscom. I don't know. My daddy always said that if a man's in his right mind... Your daddy didn't have the brains God gave a gopher, Annie said. Never mind your daddy. You've got to put a stop to that, Ricky Lee. He's going to kill himself. Thus given his marching orders, Ricky Lee went back down to where Ben Hanscom sat. Mr. Hanscom, I really think you've had an... Hanscom tilted his head back, squeezed. Actually sniffed the lemon juice back this time, as if it were cocaine. He gulped whiskey as if it were water. He looked at Ricky Lee solemnly. Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug, he said, and then laughed. There was maybe 2 inches of whiskey left in the stein. That is enough, Ricky Lee said and reached for the stein. Hanscom moved it gently out of his reach. Damage has been done, Ricky Lee, he said. The damage has been done, boy. Mr. Hanscom, please. I've got something for your kids, Ricky Lee. Damn if I didn't almost forget. He was wearing a faded denim vest, and now he reached something out of one of its pockets. Ricky Lee heard a muted clink. My dad died when I was 4, Hanscom said. There was no slur at all in his voice. Left us a bunch of debts and these. I want your kiddos to have them, Ricky Lee. He put 3 cartwheel silver dollars on the bar where they gleamed under the soft lights. Ricky Lee caught his breath. Mr. Hanscom, that's very kind, but I couldn't. There used to be 4, but I gave one of them to Stuttering Bill and the others. Bill Dendro, that was his real name. Stuttering Bill's just what we used to call him. Just a thing we used to say, like, you bet your fur. He was one of the best friends I ever had. I did have a few, you know. Even a fat kid like me had a few. Stuttering Bill's a writer now. Ricky Lee barely heard him. He was looking at the cartwheels, fascinated. 1921, 1923, and 1924. God knew what they were worth now, just in terms of the pure silver they contained. I couldn't, he said again. But I insist. Mr. Hanscom took hold of the stein and drained it. He should have been flat on his keister, but his eyes never left Ricky Lee's. Those eyes were watery and very bloodshot, but Ricky Lee would have sworn on a stack of Bibles that they were also the eyes of a sober man. You're scaring me a little, Mr. Hanscom, Ricky Lee said. 2 years ago, Gresham Arnold, a rum-dum of some local repute, had come into the Red Wheel with a roll of quarters in his hand and a $20 bill stuck into the band of his hat. He handed the roll to Annie with instructions to feed the quarters into the jukebox by fours. He put the 20 on the bar and instructed Ricky Lee to set up drinks for the house. This rum-dum, this Gresham Arnold, had long ago been a star basketball player for the Hemmingford Rams, leading them to their first, and most likely last, high school team championship. In 1961 that had been. An almost unlimited future seemed to lie ahead of the young man. But he had flunked out of LSU his first semester, a victim of drink, drugs, and all-night parties. He came home, cracked up the yellow convertible his folks had given him as a graduation present, and got a job as head salesman at his daddy's John Deere dealership. 5 years passed. His father could not bear to fire him, and so he finally sold the dealership and retired to Arizona, a man haunted and made old before his time by the inexplicable and apparently irreversible degeneration of his son. While the dealership still belonged to his daddy, and he was at least pretending to work, Arnold had made some effort to keep the booze at arm's length. Afterward, it got him completely. He could get mean, but he had been just as sweet as whorehound candy the night he brought in the quarters and set up drinks for the house, and everyone had thanked him kindly, and Annie kept playing Mo Bandy songs because Gresham Arnold liked old Mo Bandy. He sat there at the bar, on the very stool where Mr. Hanscom was sitting now, Ricky Lee realized with steadily deepening unease, and drank three or four bourbon and bitters, and sang along with the juke and caused no trouble, and went home when Ricky Lee closed the wheel up, and hanged himself with his belt in an upstairs closet. Gresham Arnold's eyes that night had looked a little bit like Ben Hanscom's eyes look right now. Scaring you a bit, am I? Hanscom asked, his eyes never leaving Ricky Lee's. He pushed the stein away and then folded his hands neatly in front of those three silver cartwheels. I probably am. But you're not as scared as I am, Ricky Lee. Pray to Jesus you never are. Well, what's the matter? Ricky Lee asked. Maybe, he wet his lips, maybe I can give you a help. The matter? Ben Hanscom laughed. Why, not too much. I had a call from an old friend tonight, a guy named Mike Hanlon. I'd forgotten all about him, Ricky Lee, but that didn't scare me much. After all, I was just a kid when I knew him, and kids forget things, don't they? Sure they do. You bet your fur. What scared me was getting about halfway over here and realizing that it wasn't just Mike I'd forgotten about. I'd forgotten everything about being a kid. Ricky Lee only looked at him. He had no idea what Mr. Hanscom was talking about. But the man was scared, all right. No question about that. It sat funny on Ben Hanscom, but it was real. I mean I'd forgotten all about it, he said, and rapped his knuckles lightly on the bar for emphasis. Did you ever hear, Ricky Lee, of having an amnesia so complete you didn't even know you had amnesia? Ricky Lee shook his head. Me either. But there I was, tooling along in the caddy tonight, and all of a sudden it hit me. I remembered Mike Hanlon, but only because he called me on the phone. I remembered Derry, but only because that was where he was calling from. Derry? But that was all. It hit me that I hadn't even thought about being a kid since I don't even know when. And then, just like that, it all started to flood back in, like what we did with the fourth silver dollar. What did you do with it, Mr. Hanscom? Hanscom looked at his watch and suddenly slipped down from his stool. He staggered a bit, the slightest bit. That was all. Can't let the time get away from me, he said. I'm flying tonight. Ricky Lee looked instantly alarmed, and Hanscom laughed. Flying but not driving the plane. Not this time. United Airlines, Ricky Lee. Oh. He supposed his relief showed on his face, but he didn't care. Where are you going? Hanscom's shirt was still open. He looked thoughtfully down at the puckered white lines of the old scar on his belly and then began to button the shirt over it. Thought I told you that, Ricky Lee. Home. I'm going home. Give those cartwheels to your kids. He started toward the door, and something about the way he walked, even the way he hitched at the sides of his pants, terrified Ricky Lee. The resemblance to the late and mostly unlamented Gresham Arnold was suddenly so acute it was nearly like seeing a ghost. Mr. Hanscom, he cried in alarm. Hanscom turned back, and Ricky Lee stepped quickly backward. His ass hit the back bar, and glassware gossiped briefly as the bottles knocked together. He stepped back because he was suddenly convinced that Ben Hanscom was dead. Yes, Ben Hanscom was lying dead someplace, in a ditch or an attic or possibly in a closet with a belt noosed around his neck and the toes of his $400 cowboy boots dangling an inch or two above the floor. And this thing standing near the juke and staring back at him was a ghost. For a moment, just a moment, but it was plenty long enough to cover his working heart with a rime of ice. He was convinced he could see tables and chairs right through the man. What is it, Ricky Lee?
No, nothing.
Ben Hanscom looked out at Ricky Lee from eyes which had dark purple crescents beneath them. His cheeks burned with liquor. His nose looked red and sore.
Nothing,
Ricky Lee whispered again. But he couldn't take his eyes from that face. The face of a man who has died deep in sin and now stands hard by hell's smoking side door.
I was fat and we were poor, Ben Hanscom said. I remember that now. And I remember that either a girl named Beverly or Stuttering Bill saved my life with a silver dollar. I'm scared, almost insane by whatever else I may remember before tonight's over. But how scared I am doesn't matter, because it's going to come anyway. It's all there, like a great big bubble that's growing in my mind. But I'm going, because all I've ever gotten and all I have now is somehow due to what we did then. And you pay for what you get in this world. Maybe that's why God made us kids first and built us close to the ground, because he knows you got to fall down a lot and bleed a lot before you learn that one simple lesson. You pay for what you get. You own what you pay for. And sooner or later, whatever you own comes back home to you.
You're going to be back this weekend, though, ain't you? Ricky Lee asked through numbed lips. In his increasing distress, this was all he could find to hold on to. You're
going to be back this weekend just like always, ain't you?
I don't know, Mr. Hanscom said, and smiled a terrible smile. I'm going a lot farther than London this time, Ricky Lee.
Mr. Hanscom,
you give those cartwheels to your kids, he repeated, and slipped out into the night.
What the blue hell? Annie asked, but Ricky Lee ignored her.
He flipped up the bar's partition and ran over to one of the windows which looked out on the parking lot. He saw the headlights of Mr. Hanscom's caddy come on, heard the engine rev. It pulled out of the dirt lot, kicking up a rooster tail of dust behind it. The taillights dwindled away to red points down Highway 63, and the Nebraska night wind began to pull the hanging dust apart.
He took on a boxcar full of booze, and you let him get in that big car of his and drive away, Annie said. Way to go, Ricky Lee.
Never mind. He's going to kill himself. And although this had been Ricky Lee's own thought less than 5 minutes ago, he turned to her when the taillights winked out of sight and shook his head.
I don't think so, he said. Although the way he looked tonight, it might be better for him if he did. What did he say to you?
He shook his head. It was all confused in his mind, and the sum total of it seemed to mean nothing.
It doesn't matter, but I don't think we're ever going to see that old boy again.
4. Eddie Casbrack takes his medicine. If you would know all there is to know about an American man or woman in the middle class as the millennium nears its end, you would need only to look in his or her medicine cabinet. Or so it has been said. But, dear Lord, get a look into this one as Eddie Capsbrack slides it open, mercifully sliding aside his white face and wide staring eyes. On the top shelf, there's Anacin, Excedrin, Excedrin PM, Contac, Gelusil, Tylenol, and a large blue jar of Vicks, looking like a bit of brooding deep twilight under glass. There is a bottle of Vivarin, a bottle of Cellutan,
That's Nature's, spelled backwards, the ads on Lawrence Welk used to say when Eddie Capsbrack was but a wee slip of a lad. And two bottles of Phillips Milk of Magnesia, the regular, which tastes like liquid chalk, and the new mint flavor, which tastes like mint-flavored liquid chalk. Here is a large bottle of Rolaid standing chummily close to a large bottle of Tums. The Tums are standing next to a large bottle of orange-flavored Digel tablets. The three of them look like a trio of strange piggy banks stuffed with pills instead of dimes. Second shelf, and dig the vites. You got your E, your C with rose hips. You got B simple and B complex and B12. There's L-lysine, which is supposed to do something about those embarrassing skin problems. And lecithin, which is supposed to do something about that embarrassing cholesterol buildup in and around the big pump. There's iron, calcium, and cod liver oil. There's one-a-day multiples, Myadec multiples, Centrum multiples. And sitting up on top of the cabinet itself is a gigantic bottle of Geritol, just for good measure. Moving right along to Eddie's third shelf, we find the utility infielders of the patent medicine world. Ex-lax, Carter's Little Pills. Those two keep Eddie Casbrack moving the mail. Here nearby is Kaopectate, Pepto-Bismol, and Preparation H in case the mail moves too fast or too painfully. Also some tucks and a screw-top jar just to keep everything tidy after the mail has gone through, be it just an advertising circular or two addressed to occupant or a big old special delivery package. Here is Formula 44 for coughs, NyQuil and Dristan for colds, and a big bottle of castor oil. There's a tin of Sucrets in case Eddie's throat gets sore, and there's a quartet of mouthwashes, Chloraseptic, Cepacol, Cepastat in the spray bottle, and of course good old Listerine, often imitated but never duplicated. Visine and murine for the eyes, Cordate and Neosporin ointment for the skin, the second line of defense if the L-lysine doesn't live up to expectations. A tube of Oxy-5 and a plastic bottle of Oxy-Wash, because Eddie would definitely rather have a few less cents than a few more zits, and some tetracycline pills. And off to one side, clustered like bitter conspirators, are three bottles of Coal Tar shampoo. The bottom shelf is almost deserted, but the stuff which is here means serious business. You could cruise on this stuff, okay? On this stuff, you could fly higher than Ben Hanscom's jet and crash harder than Thurman Munson's. There's Valium, Percodan, Elevil, and Darvon Complex. There is also another Sucrets box on this low shelf, but there are no Sucrets in it. If you opened that one, you would find six Quaaludes. Eddie Casbrack believed in the Boy Scout motto. He was swinging a blue tote bag as he came into the bathroom. He set it on the sink, unzipped it, and then, with trembling hands, he began to spill bottles and jars and tubes and squeeze bottles and spray bottles into it. Under other circumstances, he would have taken them out handful by careful handful, but there was no time for such niceties now. The choice, as Eddie saw it, was as simple as it was brutal. Get moving and keep moving, or stand in one place long enough to start thinking about what all of this meant and simply die of fright. Eddie? Myra called from downstairs. Eddie, what are you doing? Eddie dropped the Sucrets box containing the ludes into the bag. The medicine cabinet was now entirely empty except for Myra's Midol and a small, almost used-up tube of Blistex. He paused for a moment and then grabbed the Blistex. He started to zip the bag closed, debated, and then threw in the Midol as well. She could always buy more. Eddie! From halfway up the stairs now. Eddie zipped the bag the rest of the way closed and then left the bathroom, swinging it by his side. He was a short man with a timid, rabbity sort of face. Much of his hair was gone. What was left grew in listless, piebald patches. The weight of the bag pulled him noticeably to one side. An extremely large woman was climbing slowly to the second floor. Eddie could hear the stairs creak protestingly under her. "What are you doing?" Eddie did not need a shrink to tell him that he had, in a sense, married his mother. Myra Casbrack was huge. She had only been big when Eddie married her 5 years ago, but he sometimes thought his subconscious had seen the potential for hugeness in her. God knew his own mother had been a whopper. And she looked somehow more huge than ever as she reached the second floor landing. She was wearing a white nightgown which swelled comber-like at bosom and hip. Her face, devoid of makeup, was white and shiny. She looked badly frightened.
"I have to go away for a while," Eddie said.
"What do you mean you have to go away? What was that telephone call?"
"Nothing,"
he said, fleeing abruptly down the hallway to their walk-in closet. He put the tote bag down, opened the closet's fold-back door, and raked aside the half-dozen identical black suits which hung there, as conspicuous as a thundercloud among the other more brightly colored clothes. He always wore one of the black suits when he was working. He bent into the closet, smelled mothballs and wool, and pulled out one of the suitcases from the back. He opened it and began throwing clothes in. Her shadow fell over him.
"What's this about, Eddie? Where are you going? You tell me."
"I can't tell you."
She stood there, watching him, trying to decide what to say next or what to do. The thought of simply bundling him into the closet and then standing with her back against the door until this madness had passed crossed her mind. But she was unable to bring herself to do it, although she certainly could have. She was 3 inches taller than Eddie and outweighed him by 100 pounds. She couldn't think of what to do or say, because this was so utterly unlike him. She could not have been any more dismayed and frightened if she had walked into the television room and found their new big-screen TV floating in the air.
"You can't go," she heard herself saying. "You promised you'd get me Al Pacino's autograph."
It was an absurdity, God knew it was, but at this point, even an absurdity was better than nothing.
"You'll still get it," Eddie said. "You'll have to drive him yourself."
Oh, here was a new terror to join those already circling in her poor dazzled head. She uttered a small scream.
"I can't. I never..."
"You'll have to," he said.
He was examining his shoes now.
"There's no one else."
"Neither of my uniforms fit anymore. They're too tight in the tits."
"Have Dolores let one of them out," he said implacably.
He threw 2 pairs of shoes back, found an empty shoebox, and popped a 3rd pair into it. Good black shoes, plenty of use left in them still, but looking just a bit too worn to wear on the job. When you drove rich people around New York for a living, many of them famous rich people, everything had to look just right. These shoes no longer looked just right, but he supposed they would do for where he was going, and for whatever he might have to do when he got there.
Maybe Richie Tozier would.
But then the blackness threatened and he felt his throat beginning to close up. Eddie realized with real panic that he had packed the whole damn drugstore and had left the most important thing of all, his aspirator, downstairs on top of the stereo cabinet. He banged the suitcase closed and latched it. He looked around at Myra, who was standing there in the hallway with her hand pressed against the short, thick column of her neck as if she were the one with the asthma. She was staring at him, her face full of perplexity and terror. And he might have felt sorry for her if his heart had not already been so filled with terror for himself.
"What's happened, Eddie? Who is that on the telephone? Are you in trouble? You are, aren't you? What kind of trouble are you in?"
He walked toward her, zipper bag in one hand and suitcase in the other, standing more or less straight now that he was more evenly weighted. She moved in front of him, blocking off the stairway. And at first he thought she would not give way. Then, when his face was about to crash into the soft roadblock of her breasts, she did give way, fearfully. As he walked past, never slowing, she burst into miserable tears.
"I can't drive, Al Pacino," she bawled. "I'll smash into a stop sign or something. I know I will. Eddie, I'm scared."
He looked at the Seth Thomas clock on the table by the stairs. 9:20. The canned-sounding Delta clerk had told him he had already missed the last flight north to Maine. That one had left LaGuardia at 8:25. He had called Amtrak and discovered there was a late train to Boston departing Penn Station at 11:30. It would drop him off at South Station, where he could take a cab to the offices of Cape Cod Limousine on Arlington Street. Cape Cod and Eddie's company, Royal Crest, had worked out a useful and friendly reciprocal arrangement over the years. A quick call to Butch Carrington in Boston had taken care of his transportation north. Butch said he would have a Cadillac limo gassed and ready for him. So he would go in style, and with no pain-in-the-ass client sitting in the back seat, stinking the air up with a big cigar and asking if Eddie knew where he could score a broad or a few grams of coke or both.
"Going in style, all right," he thought. "Only way you could go in more style would be if you were going in a hearse. But don't worry, Eddie.
That's probably how you'll come back. If there's enough of you left to pick up, that is.
Eddie?
9:20. Plenty of time to talk to her. Plenty of time to be kind. Ah, but it would have been so much better if this had been her whist night. If he could have just slipped out, leaving a note under one of the magnets on the refrigerator door. The refrigerator door is where he left all his notes for Myra, because there she never missed them. Leaving that way, like a fugitive, would not have been good, but this was even worse. This was like having to leave home all over again, and that had been so hard he'd had to do it 3 times. Sometimes home is where the heart is, Eddie thought randomly. I believe that. Old Bobby Frost said home's the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. Unfortunately, it's also the place where, once you're in there, they don't ever want to let you out. He stood at the head of the stairs, forward motion temporarily spent, filled with fear, breath wheezing noisily in and out of the pinhole his throat had become, and regarded his weeping wife. Come on downstairs with me and I'll tell you what I can, he said. Eddie put his 2 bags, clothes in one, medicine in the other, by the door in the front hall. He remembered something else then, or rather the ghost of his mother, who had been dead many years, but who still spoke frequently in his mind, remembered for him. You know when your feet get wet, you always get a cold, Eddie. You're not like other people. You have a very weak system. You have to be careful. That's why you must always wear your rubbers when it rains. It rained a lot in Derry. Eddie opened the front hall closet, got his rubbers off the hook where they hung neatly in a plastic bag, and put them in his clothes suitcase. That's a good boy, Eddie. He and Myra had been watching TV when the shit hit the fan. Eddie went into the television room and pushed the button which lowered the screen of the Murovision TV. Its screen was so big that it made Freeman McNeil look like a visitor from Brobdingnag on Sunday afternoons. He picked up the telephone and called a taxi. The dispatcher told him it would probably be 15 minutes. Eddie said that was no problem. He hung up and grabbed his aspirator off the top of their expensive Sony compact disc player. I spent $1,500 on a state-of-the-art sound system so that Myra wouldn't miss a single golden note on her Barry Manilow records and her Supremes' greatest hits, he thought, and then felt a flush of guilt. That wasn't fair, and he damn well knew it. Myra would have been just as happy with her old scratchy records as she was with the new 45 RPM-sized laser discs. Just as she would have been happy to keep on living in the little four-room house in Queens until they were both old and gray. And, if the truth were told, there was a little snow on Eddie Casbrack's mountain already. He had bought the luxury sound system for the same reasons that he had bought this low fieldstone house on Long Island, where the two of them often rattled around like the last 2 peas in a can, because he had been able to, and because they were ways of appeasing the soft, frightened, often bewildered, always implacable voice of his mother. They were ways of saying, I made it, Ma. Look at all this. I made it. Now will you please, for Christ's sake, shut up a while? Eddie stuffed the aspirator into his mouth and, like a man miming suicide, pulled the trigger. A cloud of awful licorice taste roiled and boiled its way down his throat, and Eddie breathed deeply. He could feel breathing passages which had almost closed start to open up again. The tightness in his chest started to ease, and suddenly he heard voices in his mind, ghost voices. Didn't you get the note I sent you? I got it, Mrs. Casbrack, but... Well, in case you can't read, Coach Black, let me tell you in person. Are you ready? Mrs. Casbrack. Good, here it comes, from my lips to your ears. Ready? My Eddie cannot take physical education. I repeat, he cannot take phys ed. Eddie is very delicate, and if he runs or jumps... Mrs. Casbrack, I have the results of Eddie's last physical on file in my office. That's a state requirement. It says that Eddie is a little small for his age, but otherwise he's absolutely normal. So I called your family physician just to be sure, and he confirmed. Are you saying I'm a liar, Coach Black? Is that it? Well, here he is. Here's Eddie standing right beside me. Can you hear the way he's breathing? Can you? Mom, please, I'm all right. Eddie, you know better than that. I taught you better than that. Don't interrupt your elders. I hear him, Mrs. Casbrack, but... Do you? Good. I thought maybe you were deaf. He sounds like a truck going uphill in low gear, doesn't he? And if that isn't asthma... Mom, I'll be... Be quiet, Eddie. Don't interrupt me again. If that isn't asthma, Coach Black,
then I'm Queen Elizabeth.
Mrs. Kasprack, Eddie often seems very well and happy in his physical education classes. He loves to play games, and he runs quite fast. In my conversation with Dr. Baines, the word psychosomatic came up. I wonder if you've considered the possibility that...
That my son is crazy? Is that what you're trying to say? Are you trying to say that my son is crazy?
No, but he's delicate.
Mrs. Kasprack, my son is very delicate.
Mrs. Kasprack, Dr. Baines confirmed that he could find nothing at all.
Physically wrong, Eddie finished.
The memory of that humiliating encounter, his mother screaming at Coach Black in the Derry Elementary School gymnasium while he gasped and cringed at her side, and the other kids huddled around one of the baskets and watched, had recurred to him tonight for the first time in years. Nor was that the only memory which Mike Hanlon's call was going to bring back, he knew. He could feel many others, as bad or even worse, crowding and jostling like sale-mad shoppers bottlenecked in a department store doorway. But soon the bottleneck would break, and they would be along. He was quite sure of that. And what would they find on sale? His sanity?
Could be.
Half price. Smoke and water damage. Everything must go.
Nothing physically wrong, he repeated, took a deep, shuddery breath, and stuffed the aspirator into his pocket.
Eddie, Myra said, please tell me what all of this is about.
Tear tracks shone on her chubby cheeks. Her hands twisted restlessly together like a pair of pink and hairless animals at play. Once, shortly before actually proposing marriage, he had taken a picture of Myra, which she had given him, and had put it next to one of his mother, who had died of congestive heart failure at the age of 64. At the time of her death, Eddie's mother had topped the scales at over 400 pounds, 406 to be exact. She had become something nearly monstrous by then. Her body had seen nothing more than boobs and butt and belly, all overtopped by her pasty, perpetually dismayed face. But the picture of her which he put next to Myra's picture had been taken in 1944, 2 years before he had been born.
You were a very sickly baby, the ghost mom now whispered in his ear. Many times we despaired of your life.
In 1944, his mother had been a relatively svelte 180 pounds. He had made that comparison, he supposed, in a last-ditch effort to stop himself from committing psychological incest. He looked from mother to Myra, and back again to mother. They could have been sisters. The resemblance was that close. Eddie looked at the two nearly identical pictures and promised himself he would not do this crazy thing. He knew that the boys at work were already making jokes about Jack Spratt and his wife. But they didn't know the half of it. The jokes and snide remarks he could take. But did he really want to be a clown in such a Freudian circus as this? No, he did not. He would break it off with Myra. He would let her down gently because she was really very sweet and had had even less experience with men than he'd had with women. And then, after she had finally sailed over the horizon of his life, he could maybe take those tennis lessons he'd been thinking of for such a long time. Eddie often seems very well and happy in his physical education classes. Or there were the pool memberships they were selling at the UN Plaza Hotel. Eddie loves to play games. Not to mention that health club which had opened up on 3rd Avenue across from the garage.
Eddie runs quite fast. He runs quite fast when you're not here. Runs quite fast when there's nobody around to remind him of how delicate he is. And I see in his face, Mrs. Kasprack, that he knows even now at the age of 9, he knows that the biggest favor in the world he could do himself would be to run fast in any direction. You're not going to let him go, Mrs. Kasprack. Let him run.
But in the end, he had married Myra anyway. In the end, the old ways and the old habits had simply been too strong. Home was the place where, when you have to go there, they have to chain you up. Oh, he might have beaten his mother's ghost. It would have been hard, but he was quite sure he could have done that much, if that had been all which needed doing. It was Myra herself who had ended up tipping the scales away from independence. Myra had condemned him with solicitude, had nailed him with concern, had chained him with sweetness. Myra, like his mother, had reached the final fatal insight into his character. Eddie was all the more delicate because he sometimes suspected he was not delicate at all. Eddie needed to be protected from his own dim intimations of possible bravery. On rainy days, Myra always took his rubbers out of the plastic bag in the closet and put them by the coat rack next to the door. Beside his plate of unbuttered wheat toast each morning was a dish of what might have been taken at a casual glance for a multicolored pre-sweetened children's cereal, but which a closer look would have revealed to be a whole spectrum of vitamins, most of which Eddie had in his medicine bag right now. Myra, like Mother, understood, and there had really been no chance for him. As a young unmarried man, he had left his mother three times and returned home to her three times. Then, 4 years after his mother had died in the front hall of her Queens apartment, blocking the front door so completely with her bulk that the MedQ guys, called by the people downstairs when they heard the monstrous thud of Mrs. Kasprak going down for the final count, had to break in through the locked door between the apartment's kitchen and the service stairwell. He had returned home for a fourth and final time. At least he had believed then it was for the final time. Home again, jiggity jog. Home again with Myra the hog. A hog she was, but she was a sweet hog, and he loved her. And there had really been no chance for him at all. She had drawn him to her with the fatal, hypnotizing snake's eyes of understanding. Home again forever, he had thought then. But maybe I was wrong, he thought. Maybe this isn't home, nor ever was. Maybe home is where I have to go tonight. Home is the place where, when you go there, you have to finally face the thing in the dark. He shuddered helplessly, as if he had gone outside without his rubbers and caught a terrible chill. Eddie, please. She was beginning to weep again. Tears were her final defense, just as they had always been his mother's. The soft weapon which paralyzes, which turns kindness and tenderness into fatal chinks in one's armor. Not that he'd ever worn much armor anyway. Suits of armor did not seem to fit him very well. Tears had been more than a defense for his mother. They had been a weapon. Myra had rarely used her own tears so cynically. But cynically or not, he realized she was trying to use them that way now. And she was succeeding. He couldn't let her. It would be too easy to think of how lonely it was going to be, sitting in a seat on that train as it barreled north toward Boston through the darkness, his suitcase overhead and his tote bag full of nostrums between his feet, the fear sitting on his chest like a rancid Vicks pack. Too easy to let Myra take him upstairs and make love to him with aspirins and an alcohol rub, and put him to bed where they might or might not make a franker sort of love. But he had promised. Promised. Myra, listen to me, he said, making his voice purposely dry, purposely matter-of-fact. She looked at him with wet, naked, terrified eyes. He thought he would try now to explain, as best he could. He would tell her about how Mike Hanlon had called and told him that it had started again. And yes, he thought most of the others were coming. But what came out of his mouth was much saner stuff. Go down to the office first thing in the morning. Talk to Phil. Tell him I had to take off and that you'll drive Pacino. Eddie, I just can't, she wailed. He's a big star. If I get lost, he'll shout at me. I know he will. He'll shout. They all do when the driver gets lost. And I'll cry. There could be an accident. There probably will be an accident. Eddie, you have to stay home. For God's sake, stop it. She recoiled from his voice, hurt. Although Eddie gripped his aspirator, he would not use it. She would see that as a weakness, one she could use against him. Dear God, if you are there, please believe me when I say I don't want to hurt Myra. I don't want to cut her. Don't even want to bruise her. But I promised. We all promised. We swore in blood. Please help me, God, because I have to do this. I hate it when you shout at me, Eddie, she whispered. Myra, I hate it when I have to, he said, and she winced. There you go, Eddie. You hurt her again. Why don't you just punch her around the room a few times? That would probably be kinder and quicker. Suddenly, probably it was the thought of punching someone around the room which caused the image to come. He saw the face of Henry Bowers. It was the first time he had thought of Bowers in years, and it did nothing for his peace of mind, nothing at all. He closed his eyes briefly, then opened them and said, You won't get lost, and he won't shout at you. Mr. Pacino is very nice, very understanding. He had never driven Pacino before in his life, but contented himself with knowing that at least the law of averages was on the side of this lie. According to popular myth, most celebrities were shitheels. But Eddie had driven enough of them to know it usually wasn't true. There were, of course, exceptions to the rule, and in most cases the exceptions were real monstrosities. He hoped fervently for Myra's sake that Pacino wasn't one of these.
Is he?
She asked timidly.
Yes, he is.
How do you know?
Demetrios drove him 2 or 3 times when he worked at Manhattan Limousine, Eddie said glibly. He said Mr. Pacino always tipped at least $50.
I wouldn't care if he only tipped me 50 cents, as long as he didn't shout at me.
Myra, it's all as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, you make the pickup at the St. Regis tomorrow at 7 p.m. and take him over to the ABC building. They're retaping the last act of this play Pacino's in. American Buffalo, I think it's called. 2, you take him back to the St. Regis around 11. 3, you go back to the garage, turn in the car, and sign the green sheet.
That's all?
That's all. You can do it standing on your head, Marty. She usually giggled at this pet name, but now she only looked at him with a painful childlike solemnity.
What if he wants to go out to dinner instead of back to the hotel? Or for drinks, or for dancing?
I don't think he will, but if he does, you take him. If it looks like he's going to party all night, you can call Phil Thomas on the radio phone after midnight. By then, he'll have a driver free to relieve you. I'd never stick you with something like this in the first place if I had a driver who was free. But I got 2 guys out sick, Demetrios on vacation, and everyone else booked up solid. You'll be snug in your own bed by 1 in the morning, Marty. 1 in the morning at the very, very latest. I absolutely guarantee it. She didn't laugh at absolutely either. He cleared his throat and leaned forward, elbows on his knees. Instantly, the ghost mom whispered, Don't sit that way, Eddie. It's bad for your posture and it cramps your lungs. You have very delicate lungs.
He sat up straight again, hardly aware he was doing it.
This better be the only time I have to drive,
she nearly moaned.
I've turned into such a horse in the last 2 years, and my uniforms look so bad now.
It's the only time, I swear.
Who called you, Eddie?
As if on cue, light swept across the wall. A horn honked once as the cab turned into the driveway. He felt a surge of relief. They had spent the 15 minutes talking about Pacino instead of Derry and Mike Hanlon and Henry Bowers, and that was good. Good for Myra and good for him as well. He did not want to spend any time thinking or talking about those things until he had to. Eddie stood up. It's my cab. She got up so fast she tripped over the hem of her own nightgown and fell forward. Eddie caught her, but for a moment the issue was in grave doubt. She outweighed him by 100 pounds. And she was beginning to blubber again.
Eddie, you have to tell me.
I can't. There's no time.
You never kept anything from me before, Eddie, she wept.
And I'm not now. Not really. I don't remember it all. At least not yet. The man who called is an old friend.
You'll get sick,
she said desperately, following him as he walked toward the front hall again.
I know you will. Let me come, Eddie. Please, I'll take care of you. Pacino can get a cab or something. It won't kill him. What do you say, okay?
Her voice was rising, becoming frantic, and to Eddie's horror, she began to look more and more like his mother. His mother as she had looked in the last months before she died, old and fat and crazy.